painting to photography, from beadwork to woodworking. KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University presents Artbeat. Artbeat highlights the work and accomplishments of local artists from in and around Winona. Support for Artbeat is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Today we visit with a multi-talented author who enjoys travel and sustainability. He joins his interests together in supporting a cause called the Commons. Interestingly enough, this individual disliked writing in high school, and now it's one of his life's passions. Today we will learn about the art of writing, how sustainability and the commons are important to our culture, and much more. You're listening to Artbeat with Terry Tunseth and Robert Pack. Hi, good afternoon. Today we have a special guest with us, Jay Wall Jasper. He's a speaker, an author, columnist, writer of all sorts, right? Correct?
Yeah, blogger.
Yeah, blogger. Oh, gotta be. And we also have my assistant, Robert Pack, with us today.
Hello, hello.
To ask some questions. So it's always good to start at the beginning.
Okay.
Okay. So when did you decide, you know what, writing? I want to do that.
You know, it wasn't a lifelong pursuit of mine. Actually, I rather disliked writing when I was in high school. But I got to college and I realized I was bursting with a lot of things to say, a lot of opinions, some might call it, and that writing seemed like a great way just to be able to throw these out in the world and see if anybody was interested. So, and for some reason, when I just began writing kind of in earnest, I'd always disliked writing, you know, write the paper about Moby Dick, compare and contrast the themes of whatever. And but when I could say whatever I wanted to say, I thought, hey, this is fun. I mean, it's not fun to sit down to write. It's not fun to start writing. But once you kind of get into the groove and you're kind of immersed in the story, then it's fun. It's a little bit like I'm in the zone. You know, I kind of lose track of time. I kind of don't know where I'm at. I'm just kind of completely absorbed in the story that I'm telling.
Do you ever find some aspects of writing confining? Like grammar, maybe, or?
You know, I don't sit and worry about the grammar when I'm writing it. You know, you kind of often, if you write long enough, you sort of, if it sounds funny, then there's something wrong with it. Spelling is not my strong suit, you know, and so spell check kind of helps that a little bit.
Yeah.
Although, not always.
Sometimes it can put you in a predicament, too,
exactly,
with the
yeah.
spell check.
Or sometimes it'll change, you know, you've written something. In fact, the latest book is about the commons, and there's a word called commoning. You know, it's a new word, and spell check doesn't understand it. It always changes it to communing, you know, which is, has a really different meaning. And if I don't go back and check it, it's like it changes it without me.
That could be evil.
Yeah.
Where did you go then to further your education?
Well, I studied at the University of Iowa, which is, you know, probably one of the preeminent writing schools in the country. And that's probably one reason why I became a writer. Just it was a very fashionable thing to do in Iowa City. I always wondered if I had, you know, if I had gone to Notre Dame, I would have ended up a football player by the same theory. But
right.
but anyway, but you know, and there were a lot of writers that came through town, and they had great kind of bookshops and kind of a nice sort of literary culture there. That was, you know, it was just a lot of fun. But you know, writing is, I'm just one of those people, I guess, you know, blessed or cursed depending on your perspective, with just a lot of curiosity. I'm always, you know, what's that place like? Well, you know, what are people like in such and such? And writing is a good way to feed my curiosity. You know, you have license to ask questions more than other people. Say, I'm a writer, and suddenly, you know, you can ask questions you ordinarily go, why are you asking me this?
Right.
You know, and writing can get you to, you know, you can, someplace you want to go, you can figure out, I'll do a story and figure out, see what this place is like.
So it gives you an excuse to go on an adventure.
Exactly. Well, actually, the first time I spent much time in Winona, I had had this long dream of wanting to do kind of a bike ride along the Mississippi River. So I talked Notre Dame Magazine into hiring me to write a travel story about biking from La Crosse to St. Paul. And I swung through Winona and thought I would just spend the night here, eat breakfast, and head out. And I thought, this is a really pretty interesting city. So I kind of, you know, hung around quite a few hours. I didn't get to my next inn until about 9:30 at night because I spent, you know, but I spent the morning and part of the afternoon in Winona. And I'm happy to be back on campus now. I just think there's a lot of assets in this community. It has a lot of things kind of going for it in terms of historic preservation. You got the river here. There seems to be a lot of civic organizations and things like that. And so, and I plan on coming back and keep an eye on Winona.
You should, because, I mean, what has happened with the culture here has just expanded and exploded, I think, in the last 10 years. And you've been here too, Robert, you know, because I think growing up for me at age 18, you know, you kind of, you're like, oh, I'm so bored. But then I went away and I came back, and it's a totally different community now than what it was before.
There's a lot of energy here. And I think anytime you have, you have three colleges here, I guess, college town, you just kind of people come moving in and kind of moving out, and a lot of kind of youthful energy. And yet, but I think there's a lot to kind of recommend it.
Yeah, definitely. So you start writing, you go on adventures. How do you, like you said, sit down and write? Or what is your process?
Well, I tend to be ruled by deadlines.
Okay.
I never really finish a story a day or two early. It's always, you know, I guess the time it takes to write a story always expands to equal the amount of time you actually have to write it. But my best stories are ones where I go somewhere and I have some experiences that I write about. I'm not just simply kind of taking things just off the top of my head, but I really, you know, I've talked to people, I've wandered around places, I've poked my head into things and see what things look like. And then I take a lot of notes. I've learned to take notes as I walk. I carry a notebook with me kind of almost at all times. Just if there's some interesting thing someone says or some interesting things that I see, I kind of write it down. And then I kind of pour through my notes, and then usually just something forms in my mind. This is how the story starts. And then, you know, from there, it's just, you know, jump on the Bronco Bull and see where you wind up.
Do you like writing columns more than...
Yeah, I like all kinds of writing. I like columns and blogs, you know, because you can kind of just get quickly to the point. But I think the stories I like the most is kind of a longer narrative story where you can offer really some of the texture of what a place felt like, what it smelled like, what it looked like, what it sounded like. I really like writing about places. I do travel writing, and as well as a lot of writing, you know, that would be called kind of commons. You know, the idea of getting at commons means all the things that belong to all of us, that we share, that ideally should be available to everyone in the community, and that even more ideally should be around for our children and their great, 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 great grandchildren.
And that's kind of like your main thing that you really love.
That's everything that I do in some ways kind of comes back to the commons. Although for many, many years, I wasn't aware of the term. And most people, I often say, some of the people doing the most magnificent work about the commons today probably don't even know the word. To them, it just may be the common good, or it's just common sense. But, you know, but the commons really is just people that are, you know, making sure that there are these things that, you know, that don't become someone's private property when they shouldn't be, that they really belong and are there for all of us to benefit from.
Well, tell me a little bit about that and the books that you got going on.
Well, I'm a senior fellow at an organization called On the Commons, which is based in Minneapolis, and we're a commons movement strategy center, simply to kind of make people more aware of the ideas of the commons, but also let them know some of the practical applications that the commons offers for their lives. We believe that when you kind of first understand that there are all these things that belong to all of us, then suddenly that gives you a bit of a different perspective on the world. And that suddenly there may be things that seem possible that did not seem possible before by looking at the world through this lens. And so I edit the website for the organization, which is www.onthecommons.org, all one word. And really, we just, the commons is such a broad subject. It's a general interest website. There'll be things about politics on it. There'll be things that are just kind of fun, trivia and quizzes and things like that. We cover cultural issues and just take a look at kind of how people live today. Anyway, but within the organization, and we just think about how to really kind of highlight this idea of the commons for people. And, you know, it's not just sort of forcing one more idea down your throat, but it really is kind of saying you probably on an intuitive level know this to be true, but just stop and think about it a little bit and then think about, you know, what possibilities it makes, you know, it opens up for you.
So it's an altered way of thinking.
Yeah. Do you use visuals as well, photographs?
Yes, absolutely. Our website is kind of a photo-rich website, and it's sometimes one of the fun parts of my job is just trying to come up with a really cool photograph to sort of illustrate, illuminate, you know, what we're talking about. And an important point about the commons, I try to say this as early in the conversation as I can, you know, people get pretty quickly, oh, stuff that belongs to all of us. You know, that's kind of like the air and the water and the streets and the parks and the libraries and the river and lakes and nature, and the internet's a commons too. And that's all true, and that's great. And the airwaves are commons. You know, the airwaves actually belong to all of us under the Radio Act of 1927, which the corporate, with the broadcasting companies asked for because it was complete chaos when there was a free market in radio, and they wanted regulation so that someone couldn't build a more powerful station just two blocks from where your station is.
Like a Trump.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But the commons also isn't just stuff, but the commons is also sort of the human networks and the human interactions that come together to take advantage of these things and also to protect these things and make sure that they are there, as the Native Americans say, for the seventh generation beyond us.
So what other things other than what you had mentioned are considered commons that people
fun commons that people you wouldn't realize right off the bat, but something like fashion trends or dance steps are commons. You know, dance steps, you know, no one owns a dance step. If someone does some fancy footwork on, you know, on the nightclub floor, you can go, what are they doing? Oh, I can do that too. You don't have to pay them any royalties. You know, a lot of our holiday traditions are commons. A lot of the, you know, the rituals around various religions are commons. I mean, really, it's a great, vast cultural inheritance that really belongs to all of us. And some really important things are commons. You know, for instance, most of the medical research done in this country, done in the world, you know, is actually paid for by the U.S. government, us, our taxpayers. And yet, we end up paying an arm and a leg for a little tiny vial of pills.
Right.
Because even though we finance the vast majority of the research, we don't benefit, you know, we benefit perhaps because of the benefits of this medicine, but all the profits go to a pharmaceutical company. That's not right. You know, if we have been one of the chief investors in inventing and developing these drugs and these medical technologies and things like that, we should get a break on them. This is it's a lot of really fun, great stuff. We can celebrate the commons, but there's some just real at the core of a lot of the important issues of our time really come down to questions of the commons. I believe that, you know, one of the things that ought to belong to everybody is access to health care in our country. You know, that everybody should have an access to at least a quality level of health care, you know, and hopefully under the new Health Reform Act that will happen. But still, that's probably not far enough. I mean, so I think that's a fundamental commons issue.
With everything that you're finding as commons, are you finding new things every day to add to the list?
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, it's kind of like a treasure hunt. One of the things I love to do, and I've spoken to four classes here at Winona State in the last 2 days, and I've
Ooh-hoo.
Spent a lot of time around the country going, you know, really to colleges, West Coast, East Coast, Midwest. Not much in the South, I guess. But I like to start with a class, which is asking them, what's an example of a commons? You know, and a lot of times they'll say, oh, you know, and they'll come up with something that I never really thought of before. And so that's fun for me because, as I said, kind of curiosity is the engine that kind of drives my brain. And so I just kind of love hearing people's new perspectives on that.
Are there other countries you think that do a better job than we do?
You know, America, for all of its strengths and greatnesses, you know, it is a very individualistic culture. And that has been, you know, one of the characteristics of the country. And the commons is not a threat to that. But I think sometimes our individualism, in the name of individualism, we justify selfishness and greed that, you know, maybe are not tolerated in other cultures. So I kind of think that there's things we can learn from other places. I think that, for instance, indigenous people are people that really live by the strictures of the commons. You know, and I think there's things we can learn from their cultures, not necessarily that we want to live like someone in the Amazon. But I think there are elements, partly some of their medicine, you know, I mean, you know, they know how all these herbs and roots and things like that. I mean, that's would be a great thing for us to learn. You know, I think also there are countries, you know, with kind of a higher level of social services. You know, if you live in the Scandinavian countries or Germany or the Netherlands or France or some places like that, you get a lot more for your tax money. Yes, they pay more taxes, but they don't have to worry about paying for college education. They oftentimes don't have to pay for daycare. They have better public transportation systems, you know, better maternity leave benefits. They get more vacation. I think at the end of the day, I would rather pay higher taxes and have all of those things, which I think in the end I'd end up with more money that was actually for me to do what I wanted to do with because of that.
Yeah, it's already budgeted for
you.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. I mean, not that we would necessarily do things exactly like the Scandinavian countries do because we're a different culture. Although it's interesting, boy, you know, Scandinavian countries, H&M stores and IKEA stores, I mean, you know, they are very successful in the world of business. So I don't think having great public services have any way diminished the entrepreneurial spirit of those countries. You know, so I think we can have the best of both worlds. I think we can have a system that, you know, helps take care of people in their times of need, yet still have a dynamic economy where people can use their talents to get ahead.
Realistically, how far off do you think we are from that?
Well, I am so interested in the commons because I actually do think it's a little bit of a game changer. The idea of the commons makes sense to increasing the number of Americans. I think just suddenly that's going to help shape their kind of perspective. We're in an interesting time in our culture. You know, the recession that hit in 2008, you know, has really changed our economy. We went from almost overnight from 5% employment to really roughly, they say it's 8% or something, or 7.9, but it's really, that doesn't include people who have just given up looking for work. I mean, it's really probably more like 10 or 12, if not 15 or 20. So that's a whole new day in America when there's that, you know, that kind of level of unemployment. I'm not very handy, and I just hired a guy to come in and, you know, do a few things around my house. And just simply, you know, I'm really bad at it, and I can, you know, I may as well write stories, and I can do better than fixing the chairs in the dining room. You know, he was a guy, you know, who had a successful advertising career, middle-aged guy. And, you know, now he's working as a handyman. So, I mean, we're seeing a lot, you know, it's just sort of the things you could kind of count on. People leaving college today, you know, no longer have the kind of certainty that they'll have some kind of great paying job that, you know, maybe that had been the case in the past. Also, we're going to be coping with global warming. Already we saw it with, you know, Hurricane Sandy. More and more. I mean, just, it's just, you know, that we're going to begin to kind of start paying those bills from the inattention to the importance of the environment. So, I mean, I think there's going to be new stresses, new challenges to kind of the American dream, which I think we'll understand that maybe, hey, you know, the way out of this is not just simply to retreat into ourselves and to kind of try to come up with the individualistic answer. You know, the best solutions will come from more cooperation and more collaboration. And I think that will be kind of the dawn of an era. You know, we may not call it the commons era, but an era where the commons plays a greater role. And, you know, and what we're looking for is not some commons-dominated culture. We're just looking for there's a balance between what we all own together and what we own individually. You know, because certainly, you know, we in the commons movement have a pretty good sense of humor. So one time we were at a commons meeting in Berlin, and we were kind of sitting around going, well, what things would we really like not to be commons? You know, what things do we really not want to share? You know, toothbrushes, underwear. You know, I mean, you know, there is a role for private property. But at the same time, there's a role, you know, and we're not just inventing this. I mean, there, you know, through all human history and up to the present, a big part of our economy is actually not in the profit sector, but is in the nonprofit sector. You know, and a lot of the things we kind of depend on to get through the day and to take care of our families and things like that are not things that make a profit. There's been over the last 10 or 15 or maybe 30 years even sort of an impulse, I think, in some sectors of American life, if you can't make a profit on it, it isn't worth doing. Well, you know, but that's like taking care of your parents, you don't make much money on that. You know, raising your kids, you don't make much money on that. You know, making a stronger community, you don't make money on that. But it's still important. You know, money is not the only measure of what matters in society. And I think we have gone a little too far down the road of sort of trying to put a price tag onto everything. And it's really time to just, I think, kind of, you know, take a long reflective look and say, no, we can do better than that. You know, and I always think, you know, we have this idea in America that if you have just enough money, you can insulate yourself from all of the problems. That kind of discounts the germ theory. You know, you can be the wealthiest person in the world, but if there's some kind of people haven't been paying attention to the public health, and there's some kind of flu epidemic, or there's some kind of something even worse than that, you're not immune from that. You're breathing the same air. And really, it's about making America a greater country. It's about making all of our lives make more sense and be happier. You know, the commons is not just some imposition of some kind of crazy idealistic notion that people in Minneapolis think about or people in Minnesota think about. But this is really, you know, it's about building a stronger society.
What kind of reaction, when you go around to talking and explaining what the commons is, what kind of reaction do you get from people who may not have heard the term before?
You know, I think people are generally, you know, the idea kind of makes sense to them logically. There's a few people I found they tend to be on the more elderly side that, you know, just have a kind of an adamant, I don't like that idea at all. It's funny because the very first talk I gave when my book came out, it was at a congregational church in Minneapolis. And most of the crowd was very enthusiastic about the idea, but there was one guy that stood up and, you know, he had a pretty nice suit on, had kind of the look of maybe someone retired from the corporate world or something. And he said, well, one of the rules I've always thought is you don't take care of a rental car. So if people don't own things, then they won't be well taken care of. It was a polite but stern challenge to everything I had just said. So I was standing up there and I was thinking, you know, I wanted to be respectful. And I said, well, I agree with you. People don't take care of things they don't own. But what I think we're doing with the commons is trying to expand the idea of ownership. You know, that you not only own your private property, but you also own some of the community institutions in the place where you live, kind of public spaces in your community that you, as an owner of those places, need to protect and take care of those things. And he seemed very satisfied with that answer, which was great because I just thought of it right at that moment because I had not anticipated that question. So I think it's a new, you know, the word paradigm gets used a lot these days, but I think it's kind of a new paradigm in thinking about ownership. You know, it isn't denying the importance of ownership. It's actually rather expanding it. It's a pro-ownership idea, but just simply saying more people should be owners of more things, and each of us has a responsibility, as well as the pleasure of feeling that, you know, the riverfront or Lake Park in Winona are ours. You know, the Main Street is ours. The Winona County Historical Society is ours. You know, Wyndham Park is ours. You know, we are blessed. There is a lot of wealth that belongs to everyone, and let's make sure everyone has access to it, and let's make sure that we leave it in better shape than we found it.
I think here in Winona, and see if you agree, that's pretty common.
Yeah.
That the thought of sharing or communal, especially with the parks, and our bluffs, the river, and everything. So
I think, well, we've got a great park rec department that makes sure that we are aware that there are services available to all of us, and I just know that, like, between me and my neighbors, we know that we can come and ask anybody for anything, and you know, it's no big deal. You know, this idea of sharing, this idea of the commons almost seems to harken back to, like, over 100 years ago, where people, you know, would be more open to those ideas.
Oh, barn raisings and quilting bees and things like that. I mean, that is sort of part of our heritage as Americans, and that is really, you know, although the word commons wasn't used to describe those things, they're very much examples of it.
Right. So this isn't a foreign concept. It's just a forgotten concept.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a rediscovery. It's a reclaiming. And I believe that actually, you know, Minnesota, Wisconsin, you know, Iowa, these kind of upper Midwest states, I think there's a little more of a spirit of the commons up here. You know, I mean, there tends to be, you know, government services tend to be better, you know, better performed or more efficient. There tends to be, you know, more of a spirit of sharing. Some of it, I think, is just simply the weather. You know, you have a responsibility if you, and this has happened to me, you know, where I'm, you know, out at night and I see some drunk fall into a snowbank, and it's like if I was in Florida, I could just leave them there, and they would wake up with a hangover, you know. But here, they wouldn't wake up. And more than once in my life, I've spent most of an evening trying to get some really drunk person to remember where it is they live so I could take them home. But I think that just that basic, we have to help each other out because it's cold, has kind of created more of a spirit of sharing. Also, I'm really grateful for the opportunity to speak to college students, because I think in a way that young people, Generation Y, the millennial generation, I think sharing is a little bit more familiar to them. And I think a lot of it is they've spent a lot of time online. You know, the internet is a commons. It is based upon sharing. You know, every day, younger people are sharing music. They're sharing information, they're sharing their enthusiasm, and maybe they're sharing too many photos from last Friday's party on Facebook or something. You know?
Maybe you're sharing something you shouldn't be sharing.
Exactly. But I think sharing, it makes sense to them, and I think sometimes they log off and kind of go, hey, where'd all the sharing go? You know, and I think that's why we're seeing the rise of car sharing, the rise of bike sharing, things like couch surfing. I think all those things, no one's calling those commons, and no one has to call them commons. But that's all part of the kind of the wave, I think, what's happening. You know, I think it is kind of a new era.
Getting back to your writing, with all that we share, what kind of research did you really have to kind of dig into for that?
Well, I did this book with my colleagues at onthecommons.org, and so I drew a lot upon their knowledge as well. And actually, the book is, I call myself the author, but actually I only maybe wrote 50% of what's in it. A lot of what it was, I used kind of a commons perspective. If someone else had written a better article about this, that, or the other thing, it's like, well, I may as well use theirs. And, you know, got their permission, of course.
Well, of course.
Yeah. And so this is a really, it's a collaborative effort, both with my colleagues at On the Commons, but also with just a lot of people around the country that, you know, that kind of care deeply about these things. And so, but I've done other books more on my own. You know, I did a book previously that I kind of think is a commons book. It's a slightly different theme. It's called The Great Neighborhood Book.
Okay.
And it was published in 2007. And it's just really a guidebook, a handbook for what people can do in their own communities, even if they don't have a lot of money, they don't have a lot of political clout, they don't have a lot of technical expertise, but still the things that they can do to improve their neighborhood, you know, and that's in terms of the environment. That's in terms of people knowing each other well. That's in terms of economic prosperity. And there's really a lot. If you get people working together, you know, an awful lot can be accomplished. I kind of think of that old French folktale, Stone Soup, where nobody had anything to eat. And this guy says, well, we'll just cook up a stone and we'll just boil it in water. And he goes, well, it'd be a little bit better if someone had some carrots. And, oh, I think I have a few carrots. You know, but we have kind of resources that we often don't think about until there seems like an opportunity to use them. But I think, you know, what's exciting, we're hoping On the Commons is interested. We think Winona is a pretty exciting community in a lot of ways, and we could become a little bit of a commons case study, a commons laboratory, if you will, to see, you know, just if people in the community are talking and thinking and discussing the commons, you know, what practical improvements can kind of come out of that. And I think it is, you know, I just think there are a lot of assets in a community like this that, you know, if the commons perspective may have them seem more practical than they might have at one point.
No, I think Winona would be a good subject actually for that too. And like I said, with the whole new mentality of it in the last 10 years, I'm seeing a lot.
Well, you have a new mayor now. Yeah. You have some new people in the city council. Winona seems to be kind of at ground zero in the whole sand fracking controversy. I mean, so that's, you know, there are things happen through taking advantage of opportunities, but sometimes they happen to kind of reacting to challenges as well.
Well, Robert can speak on that. You went to the last meeting.
I went to the Monday night's candlelight vigil.
Okay.
Where they had I'd say about a good 70, 75 people stood outside in the cold and told pretty much our city leaders to, you know, the bluffs belong to all of us.
Yes.
Going
yes.
along with
exactly.
what you're saying.
Yeah. No, I think the commons could be kind of a rallying cry around this. You know, and just the notion of how many diesel trucks going through, what's that going to do to the air quality? Well, you know, and the particulate matter from the sand? I mean, you know, there's just some real unanswered questions here. You know, I think it's just a case where under a certain mentality, if you can make a profit on it, you have an obligation to make a profit on it. Yet it may be, you know, maybe in this case, it's not worth it. The price that's going to be paid over the long run, you know, Winona will be a lot less attractive as a tourist destination. You know, I live up in the cities, and I've just really noticed over the last year or two, people are talking more and more about Winona, and I think it's the Shakespeare Festival.
Oh, definitely.
You know, and the Frozen Film Festival and the Marine Art Museum.
Midwest like Music that. Fest.
Yeah, exactly. But I think if suddenly you think, this is the town where 500 trucks a day barrel down Main Street, you know, I mean, that's not really where I want to go for the weekend. I'll go to Lanesboro or something. So, I mean, the losses may be a lot more than the gains. And already there was an article in the Star Tribune, one of the columnists had done some real reporting, and you know, already, you know, McGregor, Iowa.
Yeah, I love McGregor.
Yeah,
lots of little antique stores.
Beautiful town, wonderful place, and they have these sand trucks going through. I mean, some of the historic buildings, which are, you know, the real asset.
Yeah,
the foundations are starting to crack because of the weight of all these trucks going by. You know, and I think that's going to really crash and burn the tourist economy there. And you know, and the thing is, exploitive industries have a few years of booming and then they go bust. They may find better frac sand in Brazil or something, and suddenly The other interesting thing is already one of the arguments say, well, these are good jobs, you know, particularly for people who aren't college educated, but they're well-paying jobs. But you know what? Already in McGregor, the work's become temporary. That suddenly the mine will shut down for a while and those people will be laid off. It's not like getting a great job in an auto factory like back in the 60s. I mean, you know, it's seasonal work. You know, so we just really need to ask the questions about what the true benefits are versus the costs. And we tend not to do that. We tend to just kind of say, oh, yippee, there's money to be made, and not really thinking about, you know, what we lose in the process.
It's like, what is that Dr. Seuss book again?
The Lorax?
Yeah, exactly. It's the whole Lorax.
I speak for the trees. I speak for the bluffs.
Exactly. I'd like to kind of step it back a little bit about writing in general for you. Can you tell us some fascinating stories or some of your favorite travels that's
gone?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the reasons why I wanted to be a writer and one of the reasons I've stayed a writer, despite the sometimes low pay, is that I get to travel a lot. So, you know, I can feed my habit to travel. So I've had a lot of really trips for which I'm very grateful to have been part of. The great thing, and it hasn't just been fun, but I feel like seeing other cultures has really made me think about how I live my own life in new ways. I think I've really learned a lot. I took a trip to the Amazon.
Cool.
I was working with a magazine based in the Netherlands, and I was doing quite a bit of writing for them. And there is a berry that grows in the Amazon called Acia. I can't remember the name of it.
Acia. I can't remember. But A-C-A-I.
Yeah. And it's one of these kind of super oxidants. You know, I mean, it's just kind of a perfect kind of food, and it grows. You know, it can't be cultivated, really. It's grown wild in the Amazon. So, and there was a company down there called Sambazon. That was doing Acia juice. God, I wish I could remember the name of it. I wrote the story. But anyway, and they understood that the Amazon's a very fragile place and that these berries could actually end up providing, if people realized that these berries were worth something, that would be an argument to preserve the rainforest as opposed to just kind of ripping it up so people can farm more cattle. You know, the Brazilian version of sand frack mining. And so I got to really go to the Amazon. I flew to this city where, you know, actually the main road through the city was the equator. And then I got to get out on a small little boat on the Amazon River, and it was like, you know, I mean, it was five times as wide as the Mississippi here, you know, maybe three times or two times as wide as the Mississippi in New Orleans. I go, wow, this is really a wide river. And they go, oh, this isn't even the main channel. You know, that bank over there is really just an island. On the other side, it's three times as wide as this. And I got to go way back into the backcountry. I mean, you know, just, you know, the Amazon and then onto a smaller river, then onto streams that were really just, you know, no wider than the boat itself, and saw where they picked the berries. I got to meet the farmers that sort of harvested these berries and foragers, really. And it was just an amazing, amazing experience just to sort of see this magnificent river and see this magnificent rainforest. And, you know, we stopped off for a beer on the way back, you know, at a town that there were no cars. There were no roads. The only way you got to this, you know, it was like, you know, not the size of Winona, but it was certainly the size of La Crescent or something. It's just everybody came and went by boat, you know. It was just to kind of see how people live differently. And the Brazilians, a much poorer country than the United States, and yet people have a good time. And people seem pretty happy. And I thought, there are certainly things that these people would desire about my life back in Minneapolis, but there are kind of some things I would sort of desire about their life here too. So it's, you know, it's not a case of one place being the perfect example, but just simply, I think that's been a theme of my writing throughout my career, is that we can all learn from each other. I mean, you know, that sounds kind of sappy, but I think it's really true. And Americans, I sometimes think there's nothing they can learn from the rest of the world. But actually, you know, that's a pretty foolish and destructive perspective in a period of globalization like what we have. So,
very true. Yeah. So your ventures have kind of really shaped you too.
Yeah, I think they really have. I've done quite a bit of travel writing. And I worked with the National Geographic Society on a concept of something there called the National Geographic Center for Sustainable Destinations that had this notion called geotourism. And geotourism, you probably have heard of ecotourism.
Yes.
But geotourism kind of just takes that idea a little bit farther and says that, you know, tourists travel to places because they think they're interesting. So shouldn't tourism be an industry that instead of devastating a place actually improves it? You know, makes the environment actually better there rather than worse? That maybe makes the people there more economically well off rather than, you know, oftentimes tourist jobs are the worst jobs. And thirdly, you know, just protects the geographic character of these places. And so I got the tour through Chile with the guy who was kind of coined the phrase geotourism. And we kind of did a examination of, you know, looking at central Chile from a geotouristic perspective. So I get, you know, like everybody, you know, you can kind of take a look at the world and kind of go, it's kind of depressing. You know, I mean, you got global warming, you got the economy tanking, you got all this sort of things. And yet I also, maybe I'm just an optimist a bit by nature, but I see a lot of possibilities out there too, you know, and that necessarily, you know, Americans living on a little less money doesn't necessarily mean that they're any poorer. You know, and I think there's a phrase, I have a lot of quotes in my book, and one of them is from an elder of a tribal people that live in Indonesia, and he said, I'm not wealthy in money, but I'm wealthy in friends, I'm wealthy in family, I'm wealthy in connection to nature, you know, and I think that, you know, look at someone that makes $1 billion, what do? They want to have a great house, you know, in the woods and things like that. I mean, so I think we all sort of want the same thing, but it's just simply, you know, you don't need $1 million to be able to live a good life.
Very true. If people want to do what you're doing, what would your advice be?
Well, you know, I think this is true, especially going forward, is that there's less career paths like there once were.
Right.
You know, everybody kind of has their own path. And I think, you know, you probably guys realize this now, you know, the lines between broadcasting and print journalism are sort of different now because of the internet. You know, if you want to work on a newspaper, you better know how to shoot video too.
Right.
And all of that. And I think, you know, everybody's more and more in the future making their own paths. And I would just say what I did was I had a pretty clear idea of what I wanted to do. And I just sort of looked for ways to start doing that. You know, maybe that didn't, you know, maybe I wanted to be traveling in, you know, maybe I wanted to be writing about Paris, and instead I was writing about Dubuque. But I wrote about Dubuque, and then later I got to write about Paris. So I just simply, it's, you know, start now, you know. And I think that, this is good advice for anybody in any field, but just simply the fewer monetary absolute needs that you have, the more opportunities you have to do what you want. And I think at the end of the day, you might actually wind up making more money and certainly having more fun. So just, you know, if you can live without a car for a few more years, that's going to provide you a lot more opportunities to maybe actually do the work that you want to do than if suddenly you're making car payments or suddenly you're making house payments or suddenly, you know, you have to drink the best scotch in the bar or something like that. And just simply, if, you know, kind of keeping the costs down. Yeah, I think for anyone in a creative field, you know, probably needs to be thinking about that. And I think in the end, you're happier. I mean, so that's one thing that I did. I love to write, and I just always looked for more opportunities. I kind of scan the horizon if there's a chance to meet somebody. I'm not a real extrovert by nature, but I would sort of summon the gumption if there was someone that, you know, that I thought could be helpful to me. I would just kind of go up and introduce myself and say, I want to be, you know, I'm a writer and I just like your ideas about what I might do. And a lot of times they didn't really have anything to say to me, but sometimes they did. And sometimes it was very valuable.
Then how do you, so you can pick your own projects, but then how do you get them published? Do you sell them to somebody or?
Yeah, well, that's how the game has changed in journalism over the last 10 years or so. It used to be, you know, a magazine hired you.
Right.
To write a story. And that still happens some. You know, when I was taking the bike ride, which kind of first brought me to Winona, that was, a magazine hired me to do that. I actually proposed the idea to them. But, you know, kind of, there's a lot of different ways to do it now. A lot of times there's certain areas where I've, you know, some people kind of recognize, you know, I write a lot about transportation. I write a lot about how to make more interesting and lively and equitable cities. I write a lot about the commons. I write, you know, and so, you know, I'll maybe go to an organization. There's an organization called America Walks, which is just trying to get more people to walk more often. And I said, I'd like to work with you guys. And they said, oh, we'd like to work with you. We don't really have any money right now for something like that, but we'll kind of keep it in mind. And so I just stayed in touch with this group, you know, pretty small organization, not well endowed. But they've kind of entered into a partnership with some other bigger healthcare companies that realizing that walking might end up being the savior of the American economy and the savior of the American health. But, you know, if people just get people to walk more, half an hour a day, 5 days a week, you know, has a remarkable health benefits, less cancer of certain, most kinds of cancer, less depression, less Alzheimer's, all those things. And walking seems to be the one thing you can really do. Physical activity in general, but walking is the easiest for people to do. It's the cheapest. You can do it, you know, unless sidewalks are really icy, you can do it almost, you know, anywhere, anytime. And so they got on this project and they called me up and said, we'd like you to be part of it. There's a certain tenacity that's involved. I think you just have to really know what you want and just kind of talk it up and introduce yourself to people and just, you know, hope that something happens. And, you know, for someone that just wants a steady job and doesn't have to worry about, you know, are they going to make enough money next month? You know, well, you know, there's maybe having a job's a better situation, but, you know, but if you're a little bit of a restless soul, you know, and, you know, so kind of a more creative pursuit like this could be just the ticket.
Well, thanks for joining us. Do you want to give us a website for your own?
Well, there's the website for On the Commons, which is onthecommons.org. Mm-hmm. My own website where I post a lot of my articles and keep people abreast of what I'm up to. It's where my tweets wind up there as well, is jwalljasper.com. And I will spell that for you. It's jaywalljasper.com.
I'm sure you've seen people murder names. And
I used to, when I worked at one magazine, I actually had my entire door was covered with various misspellings of my name that had come at letters, you know, press releases or letters that had come to me. So, also, I was going to close just with a quote about the Commons.
Please do.
I wrote a 260-page book called All That We Share, all about the Commons. The book actually, I'm proud of the title, All That We Share, A Field Guide to the Commons, How to Save the Economy, the Environment, the Internet, Democracy, our communities, and everything else that belongs to all of us. But having done all this work, I kind of came across a quote. I am proud to say from a Minnesotan.
Here we go.
And I realized that that he managed to sort of nail the idea of the commons in 9 words, whereas it took me 260 pages. We all do better when we all do better. That's former Senator, the late Paul Wellstone. And so I think that really, you know, not that the commons is necessarily a Democrat versus Republican idea or a liberal versus conservative idea, because I think it's both of those. But I think, you know, Wellstone was just a man that loved people, that wanted to make a better world. And he intuitively, he probably didn't use the word commons, but intuitively understood that we all do better when we all do better.
Great. Well, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. This was really fun.
A big thank you goes out to Jay Walljasper for visiting with us on ArtBeat. More information on the Commons can be found at www.onthecommons.org, and more information on Jay Walljasper can be found at www.jwalljasper.com. You've been listening to ArtBeat.
ArtBeat is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. Visit us on the web at kqal.org.